I think really big conspiracies are not a real thing. I think that there's too many opportunities for leak, and I think that that tends to happen. I think that that is part of what is going on in Apollo photos that never seems to be taken account of. People just aren't aware that perspective has this effect. It does get them all the way to the moon, at least the spacecraft. And you have to ask, if we were able to see those spacecraft traveling to the moon, what reason would there be to not have people in them? I think his ideas about it don't make sense. His ideas about it are inconsistent. He keeps changing them. And there's other footage available that shows his ideas about it are wrong. I can't say any more than that.
Hello, everyone. That was the voice of today's guest, Jem. Jem runs the YouTube channel, Humans of Earth, where he engages with flat Earth arguments and Apollo moon landing cynics. On the latter topic, he has produced two substantial documentaries, one presenting the positive evidence for the landings, and another aiming to debunk Bart Sobrell's A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Moon. This is what I principally drew upon to form my critical questions when I recently interviewed Bart. Jem agreed to come on and tell me what he thought of that interview, as well as balancing this series out by presenting a positive case for why we definitely went to the moon. I start out by asking him what sparked his interest in this whole area.
I'm not a rocket scientist or anything. I don't have any specific skills relating to this subject. I've been a sort of debater on YouTube for, I don't know, about a decade now. And I sort of came across the whole flat Earth thing and kind of got into that a little bit. And within that, there are people arguing against the Apollo moon landings. And that was a subject that had always interested me, something that kind of excited me as a child. I guess I was a child at kind of the right age for it. Maybe I was a little young. I was four when the moon landing happened. I'm the same age as Bart Sobrell, as it happens. So it was something I grew up with, and it inspired me as a child, and excited me and got me interested in science fiction and things like that. So it was just that sort of bit of it was just something that interested me, and I thought, well, this is something I can get into. I can, you know, because it's easy to do a lot of work on something that you're interested in. And so the thing that always struck me was that in arguments about the Apollo moon landings, it always seems to be someone's found some anomaly, the flag waved, or the shadows aren't right. And all of the arguments are about those sort of things, like this is going to be. But I thought it what is a shame is that there's very little talk of all the mountains of positive evidence for the Apollo moon landings. And so I set about making a documentary that presented all of that positive evidence that wasn't about wrong shadows and waving flags. That was these are the reasons that we should believe this happened, because of all of this engineering that's available to us, that we can just see what they did. All of these photographs that people, just regular people on Earth, regular astronomers and stuff, took of the spacecraft in flight. People who received radio signals from them. Rocks that came back, that NASA dish out to all sorts of people can get hold of them, that show very obvious differences to terrestrial rocks. You know, there's just mountains of evidence out there. And I thought, that stuff needed presenting. And so I set about making this documentary about that. And then from that, I kind of became the sort of bit of the Apollo guy, I guess. And the thing I heard about the most all of the time was a funny thing happened on the way to the moon. This was constantly being thrown at me in debates and arguments and discussions about this. And it really struck me how people saw it, as how they talked about it, as just absolute proof. Once you've seen that, you cannot possibly believe the moon landing still happened. And so I set about taking a look at that and really looking at it in detail, really going to the sources, finding out where these pieces of footage that Bart claims a secret and only he's seen, where did they actually come from? And what when we hear the astronauts speaking, what in what context are they speaking? Sorry, maybe I'm getting a bit
Yeah, that's okay.
off
I think
track
what
here.
I'll do is I'll drop a couple of questions in and then we can move on to what you thought of my interview with Bart, really, which might be a bit of a rehashing of what you said in the documentary. But and then the broader thing, which I think your other film is really interesting on the positive evidence for the moon landing. Before I go on to that, I want to observe that the way this interview has started, your initial comments are basically exactly the same as the two moon hoaxes I've interviewed. I don't, when I'm using terms like moon hoaxer here, I'm not using them in a derogatory way or anything, but just,
Understood.
you know, just it's difficult to get labels that don't sound like you are.
Understood.
But they both started off by saying, as a child, I was really inspired. And then, so what I'm kind of curious to know about your cognitive process there is obviously they went down a different road to you, but was there ever a moment where you kind of wavered in your faith? Was there ever a moment where you saw or read something and thought, gosh, what if they didn't?
I have to, you know, I'd like to say yes, but no,
It'd be
there
more
never,
interesting, but
but there never was. And I know that makes me sound a bit like a religious zealot. And, you know, Bart described these diehard people. And I mean, maybe that's fair in my case, but no, there just hasn't been a point where I thought, because I've always thought, you know, the thing that springs to most people's mind is, well, how could they pull that off? How many people would need to know? So I've always been able to apply that sort of, you know, if you like, more shallow reasoning to it. And then when you really, really get into the detail of it, it for me, there's no question, no question at all, you know.
Okay, I do want to follow up on that question of, is there any other area of anything where you've kind of wavered on a line about? I think it's interesting for the audience to get a sense of how people formulate their worldview. So whether it's the Loch Ness Monster or Bigfoot or the Kennedy assassination, are there any events where you've gone, yeah, I really don't know about that, or you've taken a view that is outside of what might be the mainstream, what might appear in the New York Times or the Guardian newspaper or something?
No, I don't think there are. Again, I'd like to say there were. This is just, I'd sort of do a reverse of this question to conspiracy theorists, and I'll say to them, are there any events that are real? And they usually can't name any, you know. So, but not that I can think of really off the top of my head. There may be, but I guess more minor things like, oh, I don't know. For instance, more recently, there was a Republican protest at the King's coronation. And I know that things about the way that that was reported aren't true. So there's things like that. There's things the government say, which I definitely don't believe. And I you know, I recognize as spin. But I can't really think of like a major event where I see it as something differently to as advertised, to be fair.
Right. So would it be fair to say that you would, that reasoning you have about Apollo, that there would just be too many people who would know about this to keep it a secret, you would have a kind of general application of that to most conspiracies would require too much secrecy?
I think that's true. Yeah. I think a really big conspiracies are not a real thing. I think that there's too many opportunities for leak. And I think that tends to happen. That's what we see usually is what happens. And I think it's very hard to keep, for a lot of people, to keep something totally secret. I mean, the example that Bart Sobral refers to is the Manhattan Project, which leaked like a sieve. There was, I think, 13 Soviet spies working in it. So it seems unlikely that you could pull something really big off that would have to involve cooperation of different people from different departments, people who aren't normally working together and don't know each other well. To get them all to cooperate in a lie, I think is unlikely to be a thing.
Okay. Would it be self-indulgent of me if I gave my reasons for doing this
project, which I think we're on episode 6 of now. And would that be interesting to your audience in terms of,
I'm sure they'd love to hear it, because it would give them an idea of where you're coming from,
Right. So I think for most of my life, I've come down on the side, to the extent I thought about the moon landings at all, I have come down and said, that probably happened. I think the evidence edges towards, for reasons you say, too big to pull off, not impossible to load some men on a little rocket ship and send them there and back again, and this kind of thing, without ever being 100%. So on the podcast, one of the things that fascinates me really is, and it underpins the podcast, is the idea of perception and how people can look at the same physical world, the same historical event, the same scientific truth, and depending on where they're standing, come away with these wildly different perceptions and wildly different accounts, and then start to see evidence in a way which further reinforces their account and entrenches and entrenches and entrenches to the point where it becomes almost self-evident to them that people disagreeing can't be disagreeing in good faith and must be either working for the CIA if they're looking at the people defending the state narrative, or perhaps running some sort of scam if they're the ones proposing a kind of non-state narrative. So the idea of perception fascinates me. And in combination of that, because I could just look at perception alone, but I think it's interesting to do that in combination with trying to find out and see what statements we can make about the way the world actually is, cutting through this polarized diversity of perception. So is it A or is it B? Is it black or is it white? And whilst also seeing that people will see it as A and B and black and white. So the moon landing came up. I'm involved in some discussion groups around 9/11. I'm certainly not the most conspiratorial person on that by a country mile, but I am fairly conspiratorial on it. And we've done, or open to that same, like I've been involved in a long-term project on that. I've done a lot of interviews, including people in the FBI and CIA that were involved in tracking bin Laden and so on. And I never really coming to a sense where I could now say, okay, this is what happened on 9/11. I now understand it. The more I look, the more kind of mystery and contradictions arise. And within a 9/11 discussion group, one thing that interests me about conspiracy is that in conspiracy groups is there can be purity tests introduced. Okay. So people are aware that they already believe something a bit flaky in not believing, let's just say, the government account of 9/11, and they're associated with kind of flaky people. So then there's a chance or a want to say, to draw a firm line and saying, but I'm not like those people. And the moon landing can be that, right? It can be like a want to disassociate from the crazies in the room and say, I'm just doing sensible things, like there were bombs in the building. So that kind of discussion arose, and it just struck me as, okay, well, how do we actually resolve this? Because on the one hand, I want people to take the red pill and question their reality. But then particularly when I associate in these groups, I see people and think, ooh, you should really be taking a blue pill or two and actually come back into some kind of consensus reality. And it occurred to me, like, okay, what questions could we ask which would actually nail this down? And do those questions even exist, right? Is there a slam dunk somewhere? Can you get a bit of tape which shows something falling off a spaceship on the moon or something which isn't going at lunar gravity? And if so, would that definitely decide it? Or would someone say, oh no, that tape, it's corrupted and it's whether it was transmitted back to Earth? Or are there always these polarized two ways of looking at things? And my hope is that there aren't. And I could nail something down that doesn't require someone to get a PhD in astrophysics or geology to examine the rocks or something, that for the average honest person who's looking at this with an open mind and is somewhat aware of their own cognitive biases, they could come to a conclusion. And then we could all decide, and we could hold the moon landing up as the thing that's going to bring down the US empire, or we can forget about it and focus on more sensible issues and say, they did actually go to the moon. What an amazing achievement. And the only final thing I'd say is that I wrote a short book on conspiracy theory and the nature and the cognitive processes of conspiracy. And the one way the moon landing is, I think, maybe unique in that, is that most interest in most conspiracies trends downwards with time. So I've seen a fall away in interest in 9/11 conspiracy. Okay, well, we're just approaching the 60th anniversary of Kennedy's death, and there's going to be a real decline in that as time goes by. And I managed to find the one person I've ever located who thought there was an assassination to a plot around the assassination of William McKinley in whatever it was, 1902, I'm going to say roughly. Now, even if that was all exposed today, like, it wouldn't bring down the Republican Party. Okay, it's just it's a part of history now, and most people don't know who McKinley is even, and they don't care who shot him or who was behind who shot him. The moon landing strikes me as fundamentally different to that, because every decade that passes without a return journey or some seriously high quality photos of the landing sites, it has to trend upwards. So the trend is going to go in exactly the opposite direction. And that trend could collapse at any moment with the success of, say, an Artemis mission. Or would it? Or would they just adapt and say, oh, well, these are now faked with the new CGI technology they've got? So it struck me as a little bit unique and therefore uniquely interesting in conspiracy literature. So that, in a nutshell, is why I've done this. Now, I don't know if you want to come back at me with anything there, or if when we're happy with that, I'll go on to ask a bit more about Bart Sobrel and your work.
I mean, I could talk about what you've just said probably for hours. Mm. So maybe you want to move on.
Okay. So my interview with Bart, then, I think there was a couple of things that stood out to me. When you emailed me, there were a couple of things that I hadn't really picked up on, which you had. And just prior to the interview, I was actually looking for Bart's documentary, but when I typed it in on, it doesn't actually come up on YouTube. I think these things are maybe censored on YouTube algorithms. When I typed it into a search engine, your documentary came up, and I found it a fantastic resource and set me up with the questions I needed. So I think I'll sort of turn over to you in how you want to present it. Okay, but the things that I tried to do, obviously the shadows, the shadow angles. And that leads into maybe slightly tangential issues like hotspots and so on. So that's one thing, which is kind of common. And then there's this claim that is, I think it's unique to Bart, about where he thinks he's got film faking being halfway to the moon. So maybe you want to explain, however you want to explain, what you thought of the interview and where Bart, obviously, in your view, got it wrong.
Right. Well, I mean, I haven't really heard him interviewed before, so it was quite a revelation for me. But at the same time, it wasn't that much of a surprise. I mean, I have to say, he came across as a bit of a, what's the polite word here? A bit of a used car salesman, if you know what I mean. He seemed like he was selling an idea. And I thought there were various bits of his rhetorical technique that kind of pointed to that. You know, like, for instance, you know, he refers to all these different people. He said, you know, it's not my opinion, it's this person. And I went through and the interview and I wrote a list of them all. So at first he refers to his father, who's a high ranking officer in the Air Force. Then there's a famous Christian musician, a famous Hollywood producer, a millionaire who builds rockets for NASA, a director of aerospace department at a major university, his greatest critic, two NBC news directors, people who were there, people who worked for NASA, several people, Betty Grissom, a dead man's son who's a 747 pilot. You know, he's constantly referring to these other people that apparently agree with him, but aren't really available to us. And then the other thing I noticed he does quite a bit is he, and I think this is a sign of someone who isn't being very honest, is where he adds unnecessary detail. Oh, they flew me to New York and they were going to put me up in the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. You know, the hotel he was staying in isn't relevant to the evidence he's presenting. He's sort of creating this story all the time. The other one, actually, I know I'm going on a bit, but the other one I think is quite a good one was where, very early on in the interview, he talks about an assassination plot. He said, we found a recording of an Apollo astronaut and his son plotting my assassination by the CIA. Well, you know, that sounds awful, right? But what that actually is when he was shooting his documentary, Astronauts Gone Wild, and he basically gets these meetings with Apollo astronauts under false pretenses. And in this case, it's Ed Mitchell. And he gets into Ed Mitchell's living room under false pretenses and then handbags him with this, you know, supposedly fake footage that we're going to look at in a bit. And Ed Mitchell is obviously very, very annoyed by this. And throws him out of, I mean, literally, almost literally throws him out of the house. And this was something that was said in as Bart left. So Ed Mitchell said, do you want to get a gun to shoot them before they get out of here? Because Ed Mitchell's son, teenage son, I think he is, or maybe early 20s son, was there. And then Bart said, well, we have a video camera running. If you want to do it, all right, that would be great footage for us, which I think it pretty much sums up Astronauts Gone Wild. It's just him trying to get reactions out of people. They'd wired them up with wireless radio mics, and they forgot that this radio mic was still on as they left. And so they caught Ed Mitchell's son saying, want to call the CIA and have them waxed. And this, for Bart, is a found recording of an Apollo astronaut and his son plotting his assassination by the CIA, which I think is a bit of a tall story when, you know, you see what it actually was. Do you take my point?
Absolutely. So I didn't ask any questions to Bart about Astronauts Gone Wild, which is his second documentary, his interviews, because I just think that documentary reflects back whatever you think originally. So if you're convinced the moon landings are faked, then what you have there is direct evidence of Edgar Mitchell having a hotline to Langley where he can phone up and get people assassinated. And you're going to see it that way. But if you don't, it's just some offhand comment about, oh yeah, let's get the CIA to whack these guys, and it doesn't mean anything. Right. So, and I would say that door, you know, you could say it swings both ways, right? And Bart, if you think Bart is an honest guy, then him saying he's staying at the Waldorf Astoria, well, that just is him giving the appropriate details and illustrating how important NBC, whoever, found this story. But if you think
is it appropriate to tell us that?
It depends. Just say you could see it that way, or you could say he's a used car salesman who's trying to hype up his own importance. What I've tried to do is stay away from any kind of psychological thing, because it doesn't amaze me that if you call someone a liar and a fraud, that they might punch you. It doesn't seem to me that they're necessarily covering up the greatest crime of the scientific century, if you like. So I just didn't see anything that people just aren't seeing directly through their own lens. What I did think was interesting, when you pointed a few things out about the number of people Bart has met in his life and the kind of paper trail that this should leave, right? So I think what I said back to you in the email is, okay, so do we have a situation here where absence of evidence becomes evidence of absence, in that there aren't like the receipts from the hotel or the airline, and Bart could presumably fill a book full of things. So maybe could you comment on what you think is missing that would be there if Bart's story was true?
Well, I mean, in particular, he mentioned this cherished set of photos that had been given to him by his high-ranking Air Force officer father. And he talks about these. He refers to them as cherished, as being part of a shrine, you know. So, and then he discovers, age 14, he suddenly discovers these pictures have been on his bedroom wall for a decade. And he tells us, I've looked at them 3,650 times every day for a decade. And he suddenly realizes that the soil is a different color to the soil in the background. One's brown and one looks bluish. And he suddenly realized that they're using a fake backdrop from this analysis. And then he said, I can't remember the exact line he uses, but it's something he said, and they color corrected them later or something like that. Well, where are these photos? If they were so cherished and they become his very first piece of damning Apollo hoax evidence, where are they? He's never included them in any of his documentaries. And it seems to me, you know, the photos were published at the time. They were in National Geographic and Time magazine and things like that. We've got records of them now. There's no evidence that anything's been changed in particular. I mean, obviously they're cropped and adjusted for use in print and things like that, but there's no evidence that there's sort of some extra set of photos. There's no record of these photos being taken. We can hear actually hear the click of the camera sometimes as photos are taken, perhaps not actually on the lunar surface, but you can hear the astronauts discussing what photos they're going to take. And there's a whole plan of what photos are taken when. And there isn't anywhere in that plan or in any of the voice recordings or the transcripts some evidence of some extra set of photos that only Bart was privy to. And again, like I say, where are they? You know, so that would be one example, I think, of one of the things that he mentioned that we really should be able to see.
Okay, shall we go on to discuss the physical evidence presented then?
Right, let's do that, yeah. So, what do you want to do first? Shadows, was it?
Yeah, that's fine, yeah. I'll let you sort of direct this part, because you yeah, and shadows is good for me.
Right, let me see if I can share this screen with you. I want to share this shot, first of all. It looks like I can share. Oh, it's moved the whole thing. But can you see that okay?
I can see it fine. And if your fellows can see it fine, what will happen is if you share these photos with me afterwards, I will work them into the presentation in a more aesthetically pleasing way. The only thing I know is there are people who are will just be listening to this, right? And I appreciate that there are ceiling limits. And when you're talking about photos, you need to kind of see them. But if one of us could just do our best to describe what is on screen to make the listener experience easy.
Sure, let me do that now then. Yeah. What we're looking down what appears to be a very, very long corridor. On the left-hand side, we have a solid wall. And on the right-hand side, instead of a solid wall, we have a series of pillars, columns. And then the sun is off to the right and above us somewhere. And it's allowing these pillars to cast a shadow all the way down the corridor. And the point of this photograph is to show that the pillar nearest to us has a shadow that's coming almost directly at us. So it's about just after 6 o'clock on the clock face. And as we look down this corridor, we can see that the shadows get progressively further around the clock face. It's difficult to separate them further down, but you can see that each one is at a slightly different angle. And this is a result of sunlight. And you can see as well, the floor is of the corridor is a tiled floor. A few tiles are missing. It's a bit dilapidated, this. The point is, it's a pretty flat floor. And we can see that all the way along, we're getting a slightly different angle from each of these pillars. And this is a result of just our perspective. And I think that that is part of what is going on in Apollo photos that never seems to be taken account of. People just aren't aware that perspective has this effect. And the other thing, I think, of course, that's at play is the, which you sort of covered with him with some good examples, I think, is the terrain itself and how that changes. And I think this makes it very, very difficult to predict exactly how a shadow will fall. But I don't think I need to, because the assertion that Bart makes over and over is that, in fact, in A Funny Thing, the assertion that he makes is that regardless of terrain, shadows will always be parallel. And I don't think that's true. And I think that when you showed him the picture of the road in his, that's in A Funny Thing. And you pointed out the camber of the road, the shadow traveling over the camber of the road. And you said, can you see that it's not, you know, it's not quite straight or whatever? And he said, well, no, not really. And I thought, well, what do you mean, not really? I mean, can you see it or can't you see it? Because I see it curving over the camber of the road. But I don't know why he makes that claim, because obviously terrain has an effect, and there's lots of examples of this. I can probably roll through a few more. Here's another one. Look, with these trees, it's just for the audience, it's a row of trees sort of running diagonally away from us. And again, we see the same effect with the shadows gradually becoming more horizontal to us as they get further from us. Here's the one that you showed him. This is interesting, actually, because his response to this was to say it was a fisheye lens. Well, in fact, his initial response was it's nearly a fisheye lens. And then he sort of switched that to it's a fisheye lens. Well, I think that that's nonsense. We can see here. Are you able to see my cursor?
Yes.
Yeah. So you can see here, there's a white chalk line on the ground here. There's another one here. It sort of flies off there. There's another one up here. Look, you can see, and another one here. None of these are what we should this extreme, you know, this far to the edge of the picture. If this was a fisheye lens, this would be curving in both directions.
Oh, it's a very interesting point. Yeah, I'd not noticed that. So I'm just going to summarize what I'm understanding from what you're saying there for the listeners, that the shadows in the extremities are pointing inwards and not in the same direction as the shadow in the center. And Bart's suggesting is that's because the image itself is curved, but there are things on the image that aren't shadows that aren't curved, and therefore it's not an effect of the lens.
Right. And, okay. And he also said, well, it's been done with a mobile phone and, you know, and they have near fisheye lenses. Well, they don't. We've all taken pictures with mobile phones. They're not particularly curved. You can get, you know, a special setting, I think, on some mobile phones that'll do that, you know, like a really wide landscape setting. But generally, the one that we're using to do selfies and stuff, they're not particularly curved. And you can see, actually, if you, in this image, we can see between the guy's legs, or we can see his shadow between his legs, we can see a tripod. But so it seems that he probably wasn't going to bother with a tripod if he's shooting off his mobile phone. So I dispute Bart's assertion about it being a fisheye lens. I think the lines on the picture show us that that's not true. And it's in sunlight, and we get exactly the same effect as we do with the Apollo picture. And it's on flat ground as well. So terrain isn't really playing a role here. And we're still getting this effect of shadows going in different directions. And I think the assertion that they should all be the same, I think people just aren't. That just seems like it should be true intuitively, but it's not actually true in reality. It's just one of those things, I guess.
Okay. I don't know if you've got more to say on the angles. I would like to ask the follow-up question, and the thing that's really vexed me on this is particularly, and I'm sorry this is a little bit tangential, you might not be aware of what I'm about to ask about, but in the documentary film American Moon, there's a section where various photographers are asked about the moon photos, and they're presented as being like world-class photographers who work for the top magazines and all the rest. And they sit there saying things like, oh, this isn't even a good fake, and look at the hotspot here and look at the angles. And that leaves me in the funny position where I find it interesting, because we can learn something from that. We're going to learn one of two things. We're either going to learn the moon photo, the Apollo photos are faked, or we're going to learn that world-class photographers actually don't really know what they're talking about when it comes to photos. Now, both of those things might be very surprising, but I'd certainly be surprised if the latter one of those is true. If top photographers cannot assess photos properly, because usually, you know, when I have someone around to fix the plumbing or something, I expect to turn the tap on and the water's going to come out at the end of it. Like people in these professions kind of know what they're doing. And so that this is, the soft light and that kind of thing. So do you have any kind of sense of what's going on there? Because this is a question that I've put to photographers I know, and all they do is look at me strange and go, now that doesn't really make sense. No, I can't understand why, you know, they're not going to like make those kind of mistakes, those guys. So do you have any explanation for this?
Well, I mean, the first thing I would say, the thing I noticed, first of all, is they're all fashion photographers, which I thought was an odd choice, because there are landscape photographers, and you're talking about a lunar landscape, the photography of it. I would think that the natural choice would be somebody who shot landscape, but they listed off at these three or four fashion photographers, and it seemed almost like, I mean, you know, reading between the lines a little here, maybe, But it seemed like a good excuse to drop some brand names, to you know, to name a few celebrities they reeled off, you know, and it just seemed like a way to add sort of celebrity credibility, sort of generally, to what they were saying. But I mean, the first photographer, I don't remember the names, but if you go to and watch American Moon, you'll know what I'm talking about. They sort of go through them one by one. So the first photographer says the shadows must be parallel at such a distance. The second one says the shadows going in different directions make no sense. And the third one says this is absurd. Well, my photo above that I've just shown you, that shows that they are wrong about that. They're just plain wrong. The photo shows that they're wrong. And I don't know what else to say other than that. They're just wrong. And the same with the soft shadows. I mean, I hadn't come across this one before your email linking me to it, actually. I've resisted watching Apollo Hot Hoax documentaries in case I feel inclined to make another debunk. And I don't want to devote 4 months to it. But anyway, I was talking about this earlier and someone in my Discord server nipped out and shot this photo this afternoon. And you can see this is shot in sunlight. You can see there's a soft edge around the shadow. And I just think this is a bit of a sort of a, you might call it a penumbra, I guess. And I just think they're wrong.
Okay.
I don't know what else I can say.
No, there's not a lot more you can say.
What motivated them is difficult. I'm not sure. It's hard to tell, isn't it? I mean, the last couple of years have shown me all sorts of people are prepared to say all sorts of things on video. You know, very, very eminent doctors and people have said things which have surprised me, you know, and have surprised the medical profession, let's say. So I don't know. It's I don't, maybe they were just paid. Who knows?
I think
it doesn't
probably
seem like a likely explanation. It seems like they're probably not short of a few bob. You know what I mean? I don't know. So
I think it's I don't know. It might be something I'll try and push into a bit further, because I think you've given a good answer and I think you've answered it as much as you can. There's not much right. more you can say other than giving examples of, well, here is why they are clearly wrong. I think I'd right. be interested, maybe I'll search out a photographer who can explain this a bit better, because I do think that people, myself included, look at that and go, well, there's a genuine mystery here. Like, I just can't write this off as some sort of fringe people saying crazy things. There does seem to be something very strange about this. So I might just put a pin in that one and say, yeah, before or wrap this series up, I might actually try and have a photographer on to explain how photographers see photos and what the limits of their abilities are.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it was interesting to see them do that stuff, but it didn't seem like they was kind of flicking through the photos in the book, and it didn't seem like a very in-depth analysis that they were doing. You know what I mean? Maybe I'm not being fair on that.
I mean, I did think a better way of doing it would have been, and I haven't thought this out fully, but have some kind of book that contains photos taken in a studio and the Apollo photos and photos taken outside, and have the photographers say which ones were done under artificial light and which ones weren't, and actually see if they could tell the difference. There's a bit of a missed opportunity there to have a more kind of scientific approach to it.
Right. And I also think as well, the whole process, the sort of anomaly hunting in photographs process, is sort of, it's prone to a lot of opportunities for failure, I feel. I think people have a tendency to find anomalies if they're looking for them, and think they're anomalies when they're not, you know.
Okay, I'm happy with that section. So anything more you want to say on photographs? But I do think we've covered it quite well. And then we'll move on to the, well, whatever else. But there's a particularly upcoming is one big kind of claim that Bart makes.
Yeah. Oh, here's another example of soft shadows, by the way. Look, but anyway, yes, please, let's move on.
So do you want to talk about the video that Bart Sobrell thinks is a slam dunk?
Right.
Or was there anything else prior to that? Or
No, that's fine. Let me just get back up to that in my notes. Yeah. I mean, the first thing I would say about it is he makes multiple sort of shifting claims about it. I counted four versions, but I may be conflating one or two, or deconflating them, if you like. But he says it's they're filming a 1 foot model. He says they're using the circular window of the spacecraft. He says they're using a transparency over the window. And then when you hit him with my bit of footage that he hasn't used, he said the window is a 1 foot model as well. And then when you hit him with my thing, he said it's a reflection off another window. So, you know, he had multiple explanations for this. But I was going to ask you, when he said that they had this 1 foot model, what do you understand that to be? Because I don't know what he's on about.
I actually didn't, when I read your comment on that, I didn't fully remember it, okay? Because there was a lot of information coming my way. So what I do recall is that Bart gave various explanations. So now I'm not going to say this means he's wrong, okay? But what I don't think, if I'm going to give the most generous interpretation, I would say I don't think he presented always in the way that was exceptionally helpful, okay? So with the photograph we've just seen on the moon, he says it's absolutely impossible to take a photograph like that in sunlight. And the next slide is a photograph like that in sunlight. And then Bob would say, oh, well, but not with that kind of lens. Well, that's not what you said. So maybe you just said it badly, but now obviously you could take a more cynical view and say, well, no, you are just wrong there. And with this this slam dunk material, and I actually have to say, I thought it was, it's not something I would have thought upright. The idea that when you see the Earth while you're at it floating in space, you're actually seeing a segment of the Earth with the window around it, and the blackness is the interior of the spacecraft. I think it's a pretty clever mind to think that up. I wouldn't have, you know, come up with that left to my own devices of that video. I would never have thought that was going on. I did notice that when I presented the evidence with the window, the explanation shifted, and suddenly he went to something that David Percy had said about having an incident. No, sorry, I've got that slightly wrong. It wasn't the window. It was when I pointed out the Earth wasn't rotating, which it would do in low Earth orbit. Suddenly there was an insert, but that wasn't initially what was said. So I did notice there was a movement, and that could be legitimate, that Bart doesn't quite know how the trick was done, but it is worth observing that there were several different explanations on the table. And to me, the footage in your documentary, which clearly shows the outside of the window, therefore clearly shows the Earth in the blackness of space.
Yeah.
I couldn't, and it goes, I didn't know what to do with that.
Yeah, and it goes further. The footage continues to roll. And as they roll, the spacecraft is in a roll. So it's actually rotating, which was what they called the passive cooling of the spacecraft, a way that they kept the temperature balanced. So as the spacecraft rotates, the Earth becomes visible in another window, and they move the camera redirect the camera and point to the other window and zoom in on the other window, and there's the Earth in another window. And this just debunks Bart completely. I mean, what he is claiming is happening cannot possibly be true when you look at that particular piece of footage. And that piece of footage comes chronologically between the two pieces of footage that he used in A Funny Thing. And he even shows us the slate, the sort of start graphic to that piece of footage in A Funny Thing. He just doesn't actually use the footage. So we know he had it, and all he had to do was look at it, and that shows him, I think, that his claim cannot possibly be true. But there's other reasons why his claim cannot possibly be true, or his various claims. First of all, the idea that we're just using the window. Well, the outside of the window is a trapezium. It's a square shape. It has straight edges. And in A Funny Thing, they tell us they're using the outside of the window for the top of the Earth and the inside for the bottom. Or I may have got that the wrong way around, but they tell us they're using the outside frame and the inside frame. Well, the outside frame had a straight edge, So that can't possibly be true. And as you pointed out to him, if they were in low Earth orbit, the Earth would have been, you know, gliding along underneath them, and the whole thing just wouldn't have worked. He made some suggestion that maybe they had some way of stopping the spacecraft in orbit, but I don't think that's realistic. And he said that his mate David Percy didn't think that that was realistic. So moving on from that, he said, he talked about this 1 foot model a lot. I don't quite know what he meant by that. At one point, he seemed to be referring to the window itself as the 1 foot model. But at another point, he talks about how, why would they have had the extra weight of it? So it seems like he's referring to some additional object. And I guess a 1 foot model of the Earth would be a globe. So I'm not really sure why he doesn't just refer to it as a globe. That would. So I'm not really sure what he's talking about with that. And I guess the reason for that is at no point do we ever see anything that can be identified as a 1 foot model. There's nothing to indicate that this object exists. So I'm going to dismiss that as a figment of Bart's imagination. Then asked him about the movement, and he comes up with the whole transparency over the window idea. Well, again, you know, he's shifted his position. He's essentially saying, well, everything I've just told you must be wrong. But also, you're kind of left with the point here. Well, why are they even bothering to do this in space? What would be the point of this? If all you're doing is sticking a transparency over a window and using the light from the Earth or from the sun to sort of illuminate it in the window, you could just do that on Earth. Why would you be fannying around trying to do it in space? And you would just say, right, you know, you'd have your astronauts set up, say, right, we're cutting to the pointing at Earth camera now. Here you are. And they would, you know, they would cut to that footage, and there it would be. There would be no need to try and fake it in space. What advantage does being in space bring to that broadcast? That would be what I would say to that. So I think his ideas about it don't make sense. His ideas about it are inconsistent. He keeps changing them. And there's other footage available that shows his ideas about it are wrong. I can't say any more than that.
I think that's a good assessment of your position. So I'm happy with that. And I think for me, that probably concludes all the questions I have on Bart Sobrel and a funny thing. You're, of course, welcome to, if you have more to say on that. But what I would like to move on to is talking about your other film. And I didn't write the name down. I've forgotten it. But it's something like How I Know...
How I Know We Went to the Moon.
Oh, there we go. I hadn't remembered it correctly. Asking that. And that, in, I suppose, like... So there's an almost two-hour version of this, and then there's a condensed 30-minute version. So right. I would like to encourage people to watch it. So I don't want to ask you to regurgitate the whole thing. So maybe some bullet points. But what that kind of leads into me is questions that have sat on my shoulders throughout this of what are the most precise questions that we can be asking to come to a sense of truth about this whole situation that, again, anyone who's sort of on the fence, doesn't know, can look at and is most likely to guide them. And I think two that jump out to me from that would be the tracking of the Apollo ships by various independent astronomers that you highlight. I actually found the meteor section and why we couldn't possibly fake the meteors on Earth. I found it interesting. Right, I've stayed away from the moon rocks, not meteors, sorry, moon rocks, I mean. I've stayed away from that because I try and stay away from anything that requires an excessive level of technical knowledge about a field like geology. And the one that has hit me all along is your assessment of the gravity on the moon and how I actually imported the film, I think it's from Apollo 15, into my movie maker. I thought it was being very clever and looked at the feather and the hammer dropping when the astronaut drops both at the same time. And I had to blow the dust off my high school maths knowledge, but I got there in the end, and lo and behold, the number popped out at around about 1.6. So, well, if they did fake it, they got the gravity right. So, but then that would mean that the film would have to be speeded up by 2.4 or slowed down by 2.4 times. And is that realistic? So I'll just ask you to really bullet point the things that you think are most pertinent and comment on anything I've said there.
Right. I mean, I have a little video on this that you've probably seen, where it's various scenes that were filmed on the moon where things are falling, or, you know, there's a few times when they chuck stuff in the air. They're quite untidy, those astronauts. And there's one particularly good one, I think, where there's something, an object is swinging in a sort of pendulum effect. And, you know, we can make calculations on what that swing should be, what the period of the pendulum should be, and that sort of thing. And I did this in this video, and various calculations on the speed it took for things to fall. And also in these scenes, as well as these falling and swinging objects, you've got astronauts doing stuff. And if you try and make this, if you try and adjust this back to what should be the real speed, if the falling objects have been slowed down, if the effects of them falling has just been produced by slowing down the footage, other stuff that's in the footage is now moving at the wrong speed when you speed it back up again. So the astronauts are just moving too quickly. They're making very jerky movements that are not human movements.
Okay.
I think that, have I explained that well?
Maybe you have. I have a question about it, because what I've typically heard from the moon hoax community is that you can fake the footage by, I'm going to get this wrong, halving the speed, right? By cutting the speed in half. So that would create this illusion that people are on the moon. And that might work for the casual observer, but it doesn't work as soon as anything drops, because you're going to get the wrong value for gravity. Right. So one thing, I sent you an article by Jara White, sort of prominent moon hoaxer. And if my reading of that is correct, Jara White was involved in a whole discussion with filmmakers about why you could double speed in the 1960s. And it was involved in discussion on and debunking of claims that this couldn't be done. So I'm going to just, from my end, say, let's acknowledge that could be correct there for a second, that you could double speed on these things, okay? You might not agree, but I'm just, for the sake of argument for the moment. I must confess, I found it a little bit hard to understand what he was saying. So at the risk of misrepresenting, what I think he was saying was that to get that from doubling up to 2.4 time reduction, sorry, I'm getting this wrong amount of time, to get from halving to 2.4 times down in speed, you could use wires to slow the astronaut's descent when you see them jump in the air and come back down again.
Right.
So that would account for how you could have double speed, but astronauts moving the right way in gravity. But I think it's kind of self-evident that the things being thrown around, whether it's the hammer and the feather being dropped or whatever it is, some sort of bag that gets flicked up in the air, do not have wires on. Right.
No.
So that would mean, if I'm understanding this correctly, then that the speed of the video would have to be down 2.5 times, 2.4 times. And that would potentially not be possible. And more than that, moon hoaxers would not claim that it was possible. So that seems, if it requires doing something that is impossible with video, either because it's 1960s technology or because the movement of the astronauts is completely wrong, then that would seem to be very conclusive.
Right.
In the same way that if you found something falling at 3 meters per second, that would be conclusive that they weren't really on the moon. You know, so there's a real kind of falsifiability to the gravity question.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think I know. I didn't watch Jara's thing actually, but I probably should have done. But I think I know the debate. There was this filmmaker guy, wasn't there, and he made this video saying that in order to do this, there wasn't the ability to do this slow motion any other way than on film. And to do it on film, you would need too much film, you know, because it's a single 2.5 hour broadcast, the the Apollo 11 moonwalk, and he made the argument that it wouldn't be possible to do this without, you know, you need several reels of film, you're going to need to join them together, the joins would probably be visible, you might not be able to get the actual finished mechanical thing to run, and a whole load of problems. I mean, I don't know. He seemed compelling to me. I thought it seemed like a good argument, but I know other people have said, oh, well, actually, they could have done it with this digital thing, or maybe they had some technology. They're a little far ahead of, I think at that time, there was a sort of digital technology that would do like a 30-second slow motion playback that they use for sports. So I think some people have suggested something greater than that, but I don't know. I don't think wires doesn't seem very likely. I think too much opportunity for us to, for one of them to catch the light and, you know, in some way and us see them, right?
Well, let's allow that they could wire the astronauts, because that's been done in films. I just can't see that the objects you see falling could be wired, you know, like the hammer or a wire on a feather and this kind of thing. That's what, which means the film, it would have to be filmed at this rate of 2.4 reduction.
Right. And I think when you say it's been done in films, but has it really been done in films in quite the same way? Because in films, what we get is, you know, usually tiny little, you know, 2 seconds. 2 seconds is maybe a long shot in an action movie, you know, and we aren't really seeing things in quite the same way. We're probably, a lot of the time, we're not, you know, with space movies, you're not seeing the person's entire body because, you know, they're using the bit you can't see to hold them up in some way, you know? So I don't know whether you know, it's really, it is possible to just do that in films. And of course, there's many films, like, I mean, 2001 gets referred to a lot because it's a movie of that sort of period of time. But there's a whole load of like little errors in it, if you know, little bloopers in it where, you know, microphones pop into the side of the picture and things that shouldn't be there end up in the picture and you just don't notice them. But I don't know, we're not really seeing that sort of thing with Apollo, or at least I would say we're not.
Yeah, I'd be very impressed if I did import some sort of film set on the moon into Movie Maker and they actually had gone to the effort to get lunar gravity precisely right. That would be quite something. I wonder if they do. Could you just bullet point a couple of the other things? So like in the other interview I did with Randy Walsh, his big criticism was on the rockets being able to go to the moon. So I found your stuff on the tracking that was done independently interesting. Right. So, I mean, really, if you could just literally bullet point it, because as I say, I would like people to watch the film itself, yeah. But what convinces you?
I do drone on about it a bit in the thing. I think that section is about 25 minutes long, but there's so many of them. And basically on every Apollo mission, they were tracked by astronomers all around the world, amateur and professional astronomers. NASA actually had a sort of network of amateur and professional astronomers that they knew of, that they could call upon. And then there were just regular amateurs doing it as well. And all sorts of people saw the Apollo spacecraft in flight. They saw things like a fuel dump occurring, which makes sort of a, you know, one of those sort of space jellyfish things you've seen with SpaceX launches at night. And people photographed these. They saw them through their telescopes. There's kids drew pictures of them in pencil. I mean, there's just dozens and dozens and dozens of these accounts of people seeing these spacecraft in flight. And for astronomers that were looking at them in you know, closer to the moon in the translunar part of the journey, it's quite a recognizable collection of objects. It's not a single object. It's the command service module with the booster on the back of it. That's all. And there's the lunar module as well, which they pull out of that. So basically, there's the rocket booster becomes a separate object. the command service module and the lunar module are joined together. And then there's four adapter panels on the top of the rocket booster that they get thrown off. And so this whole collection of objects is all going to the moon together. So it makes a little sort of constellation of moving objects. And astronomers are able to pick this up on the way to the moon. And they're able to track the spacecraft all the way to the moon. Some pick them up on the way back as well. And I would say it doesn't put astronauts on the surface, but it does put spacecraft of the size and configuration of the Apollo spacecraft. It does get them all the way to the moon, at least the spacecraft. And you have to ask, if we were able to see those spacecraft traveling to the moon, what reason would there be to not have people in them? You know, I think.
Okay, final question for me on this. That particular film, then the meteorites, sorry, not meteorites, the moon rocks, you right. say they were impossible to fake on Earth. And more than that, they had properties that we didn't expect. Okay. Now I will just point out that unmanned probes have brought some degree of moon rock back, but the quantity is wildly different. Like the unmanned probes being a few grams back, whereas right. the Apollo missions have brought kilograms and kilograms. If I'm remembering right, the Apollo 17 brought like 100 kilograms back. So I might have that quite wildly right. wrong. But could you just summarize what it is about the moon rocks that the layman can sort of lean into and hear and think, okay, yeah, that couldn't have been done on Earth then.
Right. And I mean, I'm a complete layman at this. I know nothing about it. But I did show a couple of pictures in my documentary that show very, very similar rocks, rocks that have very similar minerals in them, from one from Earth and one from the moon. And you, just as a layman, you can see these differences if they're pointed out to you. And they're things like Earth rocks are generally formed in the presence of water, because there's water everywhere on Earth, right? And that creates a fracturing in the rock when it forms. And you don't see this on the moon because they're formed without water. And there's also these other signs that tell you that they're formed in a vacuum, but you need to speak to a geologist, I guess, really, about that. I mean, I don't know enough about it, but I do think that that's good evidence, because there's a lot of that rock. It's like almost 400 kilograms that they've brought back. And NASA, they allow people to borrow bits of this rock, and you can do non-destructive testing on it. They have thousands and thousands of slides that are published, microscope slides of these rocks in detail. And this is accessible. Now, I dare say if I wrote to NASA and said, can I have a moon rock, they're probably going to say no. But I think if a high school teacher did, they're going to say yes. And I think, a geology student, for instance, I think is probably going to be able to get hold of one. And, you know, a university geology student, perhaps. So even though they're not necessarily available to me, I think they're available enough that, you know, they have to be actual genuine moon rocks, I think.
Okay.
Now, since Apollo, we have found a lot of lunar rocks on Earth. So I guess that's an excuse, but we know with each of these rocks, we know where they were on the moon. There's all of those sort of details that come with them. So I don't know. Anyway, that's what I think about rocks. I do think it is good evidence.
Okay. I will just mention that you do provide an answer for something I brought up, I think in the initial presentation, which was the Dutch moon rock that wasn't a moon rock. So
right,
I won't even invite you to talk about that, because I think people who know what I'm referring to can just go and check the documentary out for that one. But you do have a compelling account of how that resolves that mystery. So yes. One of the concepts I came up with for this was the idea of falsifiable premises. Okay, like this going on, the idea of Karl Popper and his science should be falsifiable.
Right.
And I've tried to do it in the either when I've interviewed people who are moon hoaxers, or from listening to comments people have made. So, for example, I observed Marcus Allen, prominent moon hoaxer, being asked like, will NASA just fake the Artemis missions? And he quite unambiguously said, oh no, that's completely impossible. There's too many people who are suspicious today. There's too many people watching. And I thought, well, that's interesting, because I'd seen people in discussions on this saying, oh, you know, these moon hoaxes, they're all going to look pretty stupid in a couple of years' time when the Artemis astronauts land. And I thought, well, hang on, is that fair? Are you going to look stupid if they don't land, or is the stupidity only flow one way? Okay. So can we have a kind of equal standard in this? And like, I do think if Marcus Allen or others are prepared to make that prediction that they cannot go back to the moon, if they do now return and they're scheduled to, no, now he's going to look silly. He's going to have to walk that in. He's going to have to come up with a bunch of excuses. So I'm not saying he won't, but it will, in my eyes at least, really diminish his case. So I've been trying to think, well, what if trying to resolve this in the moment? We take advantage of the fact that there are these planned return journeys and ask people to make predictions. And I know I mentioned this to you over email about asking people to come up with their falsifiable premises. So what I've said to people who are really convinced that man has indeed walked on the moon, what, if anything, could occur that would make you think, gosh, maybe I've got this wrong? Like, if all the Artemis missions fail and fail and fail and continue to fail for the next decade, 20 years, 30 years, if we go past the 100th anniversary and no one has even has any high quality photos of the landing sites, the same kind of quality that Google can give me of my house, at what point would you think, if you just lived an indefinitely long time, would you think, oh, maybe, you know, maybe I've actually got something wrong in my initial assessment, because it really looks like they can't go back? And when you pass the 100th anniversary and you've got little old ladies there saying how they remembered being small children and listening to it on the wireless 100 years ago, people are going to be pretty suspicious of this. So what do you think about that? Is there anything you can put forward as a kind of premise to falsify your own position?
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. Yeah, and I did watch your Karl Popper video. And I hear this question a lot. Of it, you know, why haven't we been back? And the thing is, there is an answer to it. That's the thing. There's, you know, in 1970, Nixon did this, what were they called? The Space Something Task Force, or I can't remember what they were called, but he got this committee together that we're going to sort of decide the future of NASA, what their sort of general approach was going to be. And they came up with these three options that they might want to follow. One was to continue with, you know, progressing Apollo in order to be able to go to Mars. One was to postpone Mars until 1986 or something like that. And the other was to sort of forget about Mars altogether and concentrate on robotic missions and things like that. And in the end, what they sort of did a sort of kind of a mishmash of these. But in the end, what they decided to do was have a spacecraft, a reusable spacecraft, to make spacecraft more space travel more every day was the aim, and a space station in orbit. And eventually that's what happened, and robotic missions to other planets and things like that. And that plan is what we've seen play out since Apollo ended in 1972. So it's not a mystery why we haven't been back. But to return more to your question, as long as there's, because there isn't really a specific reason to go back. So I don't think, for me, I don't know. I guess it depends what reasoning is provided, you know, what plays out. But if we didn't go back for 100 years, I don't think it would make me doubt that people went in the 1960s. And I guess another point I would make about this is kind of what I tried to get across in my How I Know We Went to the Moon documentary, is that, you know, we believe things to be true because a body of evidence supports them often, especially if it's something, you know, somewhat removed from us, like the Apollo moon landings. And there's that body, huge body of evidence. And you know, Bart made this point, didn't he? He said, oh, there's this guy, and I asked him if Buzz Aldrin came out on TV and said he'd faked the whole thing. And the guy said he'd still believe that we landed on the moon. And so would I, because there's a lot of evidence that says that we did. And it doesn't go away if Buzz Aldrin goes on telly and says, I faked it. You know, we don't. Buzz Aldrin could be lying. He could be drunk. He could be on drugs. He could be being paid to say it. He might be just want the fame. Do you know what I mean? It
Oh,
doesn't.
absolutely, yes.
It doesn't take away that other evidence. And so it's very difficult, I think, when there is that body of evidence in place to be able to sort of center on one thing and say, well, if this one thing happened or this one thing didn't happen, that would change my mind.
Yeah, it's a challenge, because I'm very happy that I thought to ask these kind of falsifiable premises, but it's going, I have to say, it's going better with the moon hoaxes. And I understand there are valid reasons for that, but because the moon hoaxes can usually say things like, well, you know, okay, if they do go back and they provide this footage and that footage, then I will have to conclude that maybe I was wrong about the 1960s. It's a little bit harder, I think, for people like yourself, who have, because no future event can refute what I know about the past, and I accept that's valid, right? Just to put my own cards on the table about that, I do, on the one hand, appreciate the aesthetics of what Bart and others are saying, that there were these missions that were contained in this 3-year period, or just over 3 years. They never really went wrong apart from Apollo 13, but the guys got home safely anyway. I shouldn't exclude Apollo 1 from that, obviously. And then we just never went back. And, you know, decades and decades go by. What else do you know that's like that? But I do think from an economics point of view, the moon landings were obviously not a market-driven process. They were very much a state-driven process, which can just extract this capital and throw it at a project, whether it really makes sense or not. And that... it doesn't mean, therefore, that you're going to see an evolution of space travel in the way you see an evolution of the automobile, because the automobile has an obvious economic benefit, which going to the moon simply does not. So I actually don't find that as compelling. I think there could be a pure economic explanation for why it was contained in this period, which doesn't necessarily mean they're just Vietnam War propaganda that was concocted by the CIA, you know?
But you know, it's funny that you should mention a war, because I think if you're going to make a comparison, that would be the thing to compare it to. It's a Apollo is a battlefront in the Cold War, and if once you've won the battle, you don't keep fighting the battle, you know. And it wasn't particularly popular, even directly after Apollo 11. Apollo had a 53% approval rating with the American public. This is directly after Americans landed on the moon. So, because people think the very obvious, very sensible thing, which is, what about all the problems here on Earth? And I don't deny that. I'm glad we did Apollo, but what about all these problems here on Earth? I'll say it too.
Okay, I think this has been good. For me, I just have one question left, okay? And then there's anything else you want to say. But my final question, and I'm asking this publicly, so it's on the record. Would you be prepared if we could set up a fair and moderated discussion between yourself, Bart Sabrell, and any other prominent moon hoaxer who has something published? Is that something you would be prepared to participate in?
I would do that, yeah. I'm not crazy keen on the idea, but I would do. Because I kind of think that it's, you know, it's very difficult, isn't it, to, you know, you can only work with facts. If you're taking my approach, you can only work with the facts that you have. And the hoaxers, they don't have to work with facts. They can work with some stuff that isn't fact, you know, that they've sort of created from some other facts. And I don't know. But yeah, I would be prepared to do it, is the short answer.
Okay. I mean, I see that these things are wrought with difficulty. Okay.
Yeah.
On balance, I think more positive comes out from either dialogue or debate than comes from not having it. And I genuinely, it's an issue that, as I say, I'm just going to hold a degree of neutrality here and say it's either the issue that will bring the empire down, or it's something that people need to stop focusing on and investing energy into and say, okay, yeah, we did go. Now I'm going to put my creative and intellectual energy into another area. So I do think the more that is done to create ways where people can quickly resolve this question in their own minds. Because the series, I didn't mention this at the start, but the series is called The Lunatic Fringe? because I'm questioning whether people who question the moon landings are some sort of lunatic fringe, or whether it's actually quite a sensible thing to question whether human beings can really travel on a 500,000-mile round trip in a little tin can through goodness knows what radiation and land and take off again. And it all sounds crazy. It all sounds absolutely bonkers. And I actually have to say one thing I appreciate, if at the end of all this, I say, okay, man definitely went to the moon. One thing this little journey will have done for me is I was born in 1982. And when you're young, of course, your parents explain all these kind of like things about the world, like that's an aeroplane and that's basically a machine that flies through the sky and there are hot air balloons and all sorts of things. And they point to the moon and say, yeah, men have walked on that. And, you know, it strikes me as an achievement, but I don't think it ever really hit me as to what an achievement that would be, as to how unlikely it is, as to how just incredible it is, until it was put to me by moon hoaxes that it's so incredible, it's actually impossible. And I got to stand and stare at the moon and really have it, the full enormity of it hit me. So I fully understand why people question it. And I'm someone who, you know, has questions about it myself, which I would not say I'm resolved and definitely on one side of the line. But so I understand that. And as I say, I think these kind of things are productive. So that's kind of over and out for me. Thank you very much indeed for coming on. And before we conclude, is there anything else you would like to say?
No, I think we've covered a fair bit. I'm good, mate.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot for coming on.
Yeah, thank you very much, mate. See you soon.